anyway, when I talk about Egypt, I go into Egypt time. And what you need to know about that is that most Egyptians have about a 2 or 3 a.m. bedtime. So we'll be at it for a while. Get comfortable and enjoy yourselves. Thank you, Quinn. I married him for his technological skills. So not true. I was in Egypt just a couple of months ago with a group from the Outreach Foundation, which is a mission support organization within the Presbyterian Church, connecting Presbyterians with God's work globally, and had a team of 9 of us, and was a great team. You'll see some of them again. The context, of course, for our visit was the revolution of last year, and we were there over the one-year anniversary of Mubarak's resignation. So it was an interesting time, and we did feel just a little lonely as white faces in the crowds. The tourist groups and other visiting groups were a little bit thin. Well, just a quick refresher on the revolution. I'm sure you all watched it on TV, as really most of the world did. Started as a peaceful revolution by all sectors of society, but primarily in some of the big cities. Soon, however, though, it did turn violent. The armed forces stepped in to protect the protesters. And Mubarak stepped down on February 11th, just over a year ago. Since then, unfortunately, the country has turned often again back to violence and chaos, and the economy is really a wreck. But there are also signs of hope. The parliamentary elections came off relatively smoothly and freely, and many people, including most of the Christians in the country, voted for their first time, because it was the first time that they actually believed it made a difference. There are scars about. You may recognize this building that was burned right next to the Egyptian Museum. We did go there on a Friday, but we got out before noon when the mosque times start, and then the groups head back to Tahrir. Pretty much still every Friday. There's also still a great deal of pride and patriotism about their revolution and the way it came off. This quote, if you can't see it, and if you folks sitting over here can't see well, you might consider moving, because the slides are a significant part of the presentation tonight. Oh, then you can't hear. Well, that's a problem. So this quote from Austrian President Fischer: "The people of Egypt are the greatest people on earth, and they deserve the Nobel Prize for Peace." This and some others were lining the walkway in the airport as we arrived. There was a great deal of euphoria around the time of the revolution, and a great deal of hope among the Christians for a new era of understanding and cooperation between Muslims and Christians. There had been some violence, a church bombing on New Year's Eve, and various other incidents going on. And the unity that we all saw on TV between the Muslims and the Christians, protecting one another in their prayers and such in Tahrir Square, gave the Christians a great deal of optimism that perhaps something new was happening. This was just a painting on a wall across the street from the seminary in the part of Cairo where we stayed there. You can see a Christian in the red, and that's a Muslim in the black. Together with the white between them, they make the Egyptian flag, and this show of peace and unity. Well, quickly after the revolution, the euphoria began to fade, and more questions arose. Christians have been quite shocked by the strength of the Muslim Brotherhood, and even more so the strength of the Salafi party, the Salafists, the rise of not Islam. Islam, of course, is 90% of the population of Egypt. Egypt is a very religious country. Perhaps I've heard it described as the most religious country in the world. I don't know how you measure that sort of thing. But I wouldn't be able to be the judge, but I tell you, you can tell immediately. There is no hiding, there is no subtlety to religion in Egypt. Over the 12 years I've been going, each visit, more and more women are veiled or now even wearing full burqas, and more men, and I've only seen this over the last 4 or 5 years, have, and I'll show you this when we get to it, this kind of bruise mark in the middle of their foreheads from where their foreheads hit the ground for their prayers. I've heard that there is makeup that you can buy to apply that, but it is quite a public show of your religion. Many people, many businesses build mosques within, it also protects them from having to pay tax, but anyway, so there are mosques everywhere. This is a very religious society. The surprise to the Christians is the popularity of Islamism, which is a desire not just to practice their religion, but to impose it on the full society through the government. That's the best thumbnail sketch I can do for you. I'm sure some of you could do better, but you'll have to put up with that. In response to the revolution, there were interesting things going on among the Christian community. One was during that time of total chaos when the police disappeared and Egyptians were all out in their streets and their neighborhoods protecting themselves from the thugs who had been released from the jails. The Christians and the Muslims were standing side by side protecting their families and their neighborhoods. And some wonderful relationships were built. And those relationships continue, most of them, to be strong and to be very fruitful as areas for sharing the good news of Christ. The Bible Society of Egypt is a very creative ministry. The head of the Bible Society, Ramez Hatala, is a dear man. He has spoken at Urbana. He was the program leader for the Lausanne Mission Conference in Cape Town last year. A global Christian leader and a wise man to whom we turn to ask what is going on. I want to share with you here at the front while you're still paying attention his words, what he wanted most to share with American Christians about the situation in Egypt now. And his words are, please support all of Egypt and not just the Christian minority. When Westerners only speak for the Christians, it actually functions to divide the Christians from the rest of Egyptian society and separates them and becomes destructive. In addition to that, he encouraged us to support and encourage moderate and liberal Muslims and to encourage them to find their voice, encourage them to speak up. As Ramez said, it is probably the liberal Muslims who have perhaps even more than the Christians to lose if the Islamists take over. So having shared that word, the Bible Society jumped in. This promotion was out within a week of the revolution to rebuild Egypt, calling on Christians and Muslims to do this together. It was a promotion of books from the Old Testament focusing on Ezra and Nehemiah and the rebuilding of Jerusalem and God's faithfulness and promises. And then within another month or so, when conversations had begun about the Constitution, they had another promotion out, which of all things was the was Matthew 5-7, the Sermon on the Mount, with a subtle question: what about these values as the basis for a society? And interesting question. Got a lot of people reading those books in Matthew. And then around April or May, I don't remember exactly, there was a protest by Christians near one of the garbage villages in Cairo, and then they were attacked, and somewhere between 19 and 20-some Christians were killed. In response to that, the next major paper — they don't do big Sunday papers, maybe it was a Friday paper — this ad was up featuring Jeremiah 29:7, the prophet Jeremiah's words to the exiles from Israel when they were taken to Babylon: seek the peace and the prosperity, the salam in Arabic, or shalom in Hebrew, of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Ramez wants to encourage the Christians to see God's hand in what is going on, to seek God's hand and God's will, and ask what is God's call for us in this time, instead of just asking what are the risks and the dangers to us in this time. And so this ad was out, but addressed not just to Christians, also to Muslims, because the tagline is, "Let us work and pray together for the peace and unity of Egypt." Instead of Christians publicly coming out condemning that attack on the Christians, this was an attempt to seek and to build peace and to say, let's continue to try to move forward together. The revolution also brought greater occasions for Christians to engage in other ways. There were church youth groups out cleaning up the streets and repainting, as you can see, following the revolution and all that had happened. That's an interesting youth mission day, huh? Local Presbyterian church that's a block from Tahrir Square had opened during the revolution, opened their doors as a makeshift clinic and pharmacy. Muslim as well as Christian doctors and nurses and pharmacists were working there and serving all the people side by side. Some of the Muslims who were coming have been working there for so long now that they continue to go to see their friends and call themselves members of the Church of the Revolution. So it's really quite funny. Of course, they are still Muslims, but an interesting ministry. And some things, some huge gatherings of Christians have happened in ways that could never have happened before the revolution. This was 11-11-11, this last fall, an ecumenical prayer day. So it included the Coptic Orthodox. I'll get to this in a minute, breaking down the church, describing that for you. The Catholics, the Protestants, all the various Protestant groups together in prayer. Took place, if you know, the garbage village of Mokattam and the cave churches at the top of those that garbage village. There were somewhere between 50 and 71,000. 71,000 was the official count, but many say that's not actually physically possible for that many people to get into that area. But in prayer for a night together, quite an amazing event. And then again on New Year's Eve this year, there was a very public, very open Christian worship service in Tahrir Square, to which they invited the General Society, and in which many, many Muslims participated. Again, just an unprecedented opportunity for the church to step outside its walls. Interestingly, the man who preached at that service is actually an elder of the church, not one of the pastors, because the pastors of that church are so public and so associated in many people's minds with outreach with Muslims that it was not a good idea for them to do that service. So they had one of their elders speak, and then he was just elected in this last round to the new Senate in Egypt. So the churches all over Egypt, and I had never seen an Egyptian flag. Maybe I just never noticed them because they were, you know, very subtly in the back corner or something hung. But every Christian church we were in this time had flags very prominently displayed, sometimes draped over the cross. And it was really interesting to see, quite eager to say to the society, we are Egyptian and we are proud of it. And even in this remote village church out an hour outside of Luxor, where otherwise we didn't hear a word about the revolution or about anything else going on in Egypt, except in their little village. But there's the flag up in the front of their little sanctuary, this little church that's about to fall down, incidentally. Can you see much in that picture? That was actually a sandstorm. A friend sent me this picture a week or two ago. That is Tahrir Square. And this is my disclaimer slide, because this is about how clearly we see what's coming in Egypt, or even what's going on there now. So I'm going to talk for a long time, and I'm going to say a lot of things, but please hear me through a sandstorm. Egypt, as I said, is a very religious country, always has been. For the last 6,000 years, there are great signs of their pursuit of eternal life and knowing and pleasing the gods. Of course, Egypt is part of the Holy Land, where the stories in our scriptures, many of them took place, from Abraham's sojourn there and Joseph going back, Moses leading the people out of their slavery. And then, as you see here, the very popular story, of course, of the Holy Family fleeing from Herod and going to Egypt as refugees. On the left is, if you've been to Egypt, you will recognize the Ankh, the key of life, the symbol of eternity. And on the right, you will see a cross that looks very much like the Ankh, doesn't it? Yes, well, when the Christian gospel came to Egypt, just as missionaries do now, they looked for bridges for the gospel to that culture. And the bridges were everywhere. And this symbol of the key of life, the key of eternity, and its similarity to the Christian cross was one of those great connections. And so the Ankh was used actually by their early church in Egypt and continues to be used by some of the churches as a form of the cross. The main church in Egypt, we'll get to the stats next, but it's the Coptic Orthodox Church. Coptic means Egypt. You hear it? Egyptian. Coptic just means Egyptian. So it's Orthodox that is what distinguishes the churches. It is the Christians in Egypt who are the direct descendants of the pharaohs and the ancient Egyptians, and don't have their blood mixed with the Arabs because they are not part of the broader Arab and Muslim society. So the Egyptians are very proud of, the Christian Egyptians are very proud of their history. There were Jews from Alexandria present in Acts 2 at Pentecost, and they, of course, took the new Christian faith back to Egypt. And then the Apostle Mark is the one who is credited by the Egyptian church as taking the gospel and really starting the church in Egypt. I hope you can see this. The population in Egypt in 2011 was somewhere around 82 million. They don't do censuses and counting like we do. So all the numbers are estimates. Every person in Egypt carries an ID card on them at all times. And their ID card indicates whether they are a Muslim or a Christian. Most of the time, your name will also indicate that. But those are the two choices. 90% of the population of Egypt right now are Sunni Muslim, and that number is growing, and the percentage of Christians is declining for many reasons. Right now, somewhere between 10 and 12% of the population are Christian. Now, that's in quotation marks because at least half of the Christians are completely nominal. It says they're Christian on their ID card. They may not even know how that is different from being a Muslim. That's how nominal many are. So half of the Christians are completely unchurched. 10% of the Christians are evangelical or Protestant, and most of those are Presbyterian. So 10% of 10% are those that I'm talking about tonight. Okay, it's about 330. We don't even have a clear count of the number of Presbyterian churches, somewhere between 310 and 330. But there's a good reason for that, and that is because there are so many churches being started that many of them are being started unofficially, and they don't know whether to count them or not. And so of about 3,000 total churches in Egypt. So, on the other hand, here's a view of the skyline. Can you count the minarets? One of my early trips, we played this game in the bus, and you get a lot of bus time in Cairo because the traffic is awful, and most of the time it's at a complete standstill. And so the game we played was to see if there was ever a moment when we were out of sight of at least one mosque. And we never actually found a time except when we headed up towards Alexandria up the desert road. As I said, it is a very religious country. And persecution is well known to the church in Egypt. In fact, there has never been a time in its history that the church in Egypt has not been persecuted in some way. When the church started, it was under the Roman Empire. There are estimates that maybe 100,000 Christians were martyred in Egypt under the Roman Empire. Do you recognize this? This is St. Catherine's Monastery. What do you know about St. Catherine's Monastery? Where is it? It's in Sinai. It's at the foot of Mount Sinai. Is that a significant mountain to Christians? Why in the world would a monastery be called St. Catherine's if it's right at, you know, they claim to have the burning bush still inside this monastery? You know, I could think of some other names, but St. Catherine was a well-known martyr under the Romans, and of course her relics are there, and they renamed the monastery somewhere during the Middle Ages in order to attract more pilgrims, because apparently saints sold better than biblical heroes. But what does this look like? It looks like a fortress. Why do you suppose it looks like a fortress instead of a monastery? Survival, exactly, exactly. And it has been attacked many times. You may see the mosque inside the monastery walls. It's an interesting place. And yes, the goal is survival. To me, this is a picture of most of the history of the church in Egypt, an attempt to survive, to hold on to preserve the faith, as Paul wrote to Timothy, preserve the faith, preserve the truth of the gospel. And the church in Egypt has faithfully done that. The scriptures were translated early on into Coptic, which was the local language, and the church in Egypt is one of the few in northern Africa to have survived the Muslim conquest and to have held. But it has affected the church, which, I mean, when you live like this, you develop kind of a fortress mentality. And one of the things about a fortress mentality is you don't tend to have a great mission, vision. And so that is what I have seen as, other than the flags, the biggest change in the Egyptian church in the last 10 or so years is coming out of so many centuries of a fortress mentality and actually seeing itself and acting as a mission sending, not just a mission receiving church. And again, here I'm speaking primarily of the Presbyterian Church in Egypt. The Presbyterian mission work from the old, I believe it was the Southern Presbyterian, Northern? Okay, all right. 1854, thank you. Started their work now over 150 years ago, a few years ago, they had the 150th anniversary of the Presbyterian mission in Egypt. A couple places I'm going to mention. You may see over here on the Red Sea, Port Safaga. I will talk about that brand new church development. And you might see Luxor there, south of Valley of the Kings and Thebes. And then a little bit north is Kenna. And I'll talk about a church in between those two also.
We have a pointer on there, you know. Just touch it really lightly, right like that, and that just shows them where it is.
Oh, look at there. Okay. So here's Safaga. And here is Valley of the Kings, and up here is Kenna. So this is the area. I will also be talking about El Minya, and Jim and Clyde will know that city. So we will head there. This was the first, don't you love this, the first Egyptian Presbytery meeting. I think we should dress like that still. Oh, wait, I wouldn't be there. So, so let me tell you a story of one of the first two churches. The second church started by the Presbyterian mission, the church in Kus, which is between Luxor and Kenna that I just showed you. Kind of a medium-sized town on the Nile. Everything's on the Nile, except those on the Red Sea. So, Kus was started just a few years after the Presbyterian mission began. Now, again, it kind of looks like a fortress, doesn't it? You got this wall around it. You know, that gives the Christians a place to be themselves, their own community inside those walls, to know their children are safe, to know that they can worship. Generally, the schools and the hospitals were outside the church walls, outside the church compound. And for that reason, most of those have been lost to the church in Egypt. I hope you can see FM Stephanos. FM just means let's respect this man. It's a respectful title. He was one of the first converts in this new mission church. Had been a leader in the community and a leader in the Coptic Orthodox Church, but fell in love with Jesus through the stories that these missionaries were telling and the education and the medical care that they were providing. And so he wanted to join this new church. Well, word of this got around in the community, and they banished him to Sudan, sent him off in a boat with his Bible south to Sudan. This was, of course, before the Aswan Dam. And, well, an American ambassador in Cairo intervened on his behalf, and they actually brought him back to Kus, and he became one of the founding members of this church. You can't see great here, but the woman in the brown robe, this is what most village women dress in. The other two women were from Luxor with us. But this is a large sanctuary. A few hundred could be seated in there. But in 2005, there were only five people worshiping in this church. They had been 20 years with no pastor. They had lost the schools and most of their land, a hospital, and the church itself was very unsafe, about to fall down. And then this young man who was sitting on the bed there, Waleed, he was working in the tourism industry, and he was in Luxor, was from Kenna, but that was too far to get to for a church, and he was missing village life. And so he took probably the bus down to Coos one Sunday to worship with people like him and found that this church was nearly dead. And he was so grieved that he decided to help them out. And so he started going every Sunday to preach for them and lead, and people started coming back to the church. And, well, he was an electrician also, so he could fix some things, and then they retiled, and then the seminary in Cairo had started a new lay pastor training program. And so for 2 years, he ran back and forth between Coos and Cairo to get his lay pastor training certificate. And he's been pastoring now for three years full time. You see a kind of a Byzantine looking contraption on his leg. He had a little run in with a minibus riding his motorcycle in Cairo on his way to pick up a donation for the church from a previous member of Coos. And so he's been recovering. He has that contraption off as of 2 weeks ago and is in physical therapy, relearning to walk. He has done wonderful things for this church. It's just a delight to hear him talk about it. This village, you know, of course, they've been a generation with no Presbyterian pastor. So they kind of looked at him and like, he don't look like a pastor. He certainly didn't look like the Coptic Orthodox priest. So the next week he came back all in black with a big cross around his neck. And they're like, that's better. Okay, now we can call you pastor. And so, you know, he was trying to be whatever it took for people to understand his role. Well, now the entire community understands his role, including in this community. The Muslims are very positive towards the church. In fact, they came and shared in worship and a party with them on New Year's Eve in the church. Many Muslims, they invite him to speak at their big events. Many come to him in the church. Obviously, he has not been going out for counseling and prayer. It's just very open in that community. Just a word, as security is expected to be tightening again in Egypt, you will notice perhaps I'm only using first names, and will be showing some discretion and not talking about everything I'd love to talk with you all about in case this is being recorded and going to be put online. Are we being recorded? Oh, yep, see, I thought so. So, wonderful ministry in the community. You can see some of our team and some of the members of their church gathered here in that study just for storytelling the day we were there. Children everywhere. This is just outside the wall of the church. And you can see, especially in that top picture, some of the poverty in these villages. And, you know, as the economy in Luxor nearby has fallen, the economies even out in the villages are really, really hurting. And the churches have been reaching out, have done everything they can to help and support in their communities. You see the old and the new generation. They're standing next, and the kids just outside the walls. Now, this very classy lady is moving from Cairo back to Coos. She is indeed the great-granddaughter of that man who had been banished to Sudan. And hearing that the church is recovering, she has moved back to help and to be part of her family heritage church. Yes, Aflam, beautiful woman. Very bright. So we left that little church and we got in a little minibus to cross the village. And this woman was on the bus with our group. Our group was most of the minibus, but she and her handicapped son were in there also. And when she got out, she said, "You brought light to our town today." That's a lovely word. And we took the little minibus down to where we got on and boarded for our Nile cruise. Yeah, if you ever travel with me, we go first class all the way. You just need to know that. This was actually a water taxi, and the charge was 2 cents per person. So that's about 10 cents in Egyptian. So kind of broke the bank paying for that one. But it was quite an experience. Another day, we went out to the church in Safaga, which is the one out on the Red Sea coast that I showed you. This church is southern. It has never had a Protestant church there. And about 6 years ago, I was at a meeting in Luxor of the two presbyteries in southernmost Egypt, and the synod was working with them to do some strategic long-range planning and to set some common goals together as presbyteries. Well, the one thing that came out of that was to build a conference center for the Christians of southern Egypt over in Safaga. And here is the conference center that came out of that. It was a great joy for me to see this, since Outreach Foundation and our church in Colorado Springs had helped support that project. Well, sitting on a sofa there about a year after it had started running, Bryce, who's a PCUSA co-worker, and pastors Daoud and Reda, who are two other pastors from that southernmost presbytery, were having a, I don't know if it was a conference or a presbytery meeting, but they got started talking about what God was calling them to do next cooperatively. Now these, okay, there's 15 churches in the presbytery of El Olya. Five of them are actually viable in that they can afford their pastors, okay? All 15 of them are in danger of falling down, okay? These are not rich, city, strong churches, but they decided that they needed to start a new church development out here in Safaga for that community because there were Christians there they had discovered when they built the conference center, with nowhere to worship. And so Pastor Reda left his church and moved out there with his wife and started meeting with Christian families. There's 70 families he meets with now after a year. Whenever they can gather somewhere for worship, they can't meet regularly at the conference center, or the conference center, if it's functioning as a church, could lose its license, its complex. But so they meet in people's homes or small groups or just with the pastor. And once every couple of months, when there's a big conference at the conference center, they can all gather and meet there. So we were there for a big youth conference, and so a lot of the congregation gathered. So here's one of those 70 new families. All 70 families are brand new believers. So we were asking Reda, "Well, what do you do for leaders in the church?" He said, "Well, there's me and my wife and the leader of the conference center." They have no elders. It's an uphill road, but this church has already started missions in other little villages down along the coast towards Sudan. And I just got a piece of land 2 weeks ago. So pray for them, because a church without a building is not legally registered, cannot be, I mean, that doesn't guarantee you'll be legally registered, but you can't be legally registered without that. Okay, let's see, where are we on time? It's quarter till. Do I need to stop telling stories? Five, okay. I really want to tell you about this church, but I can't. So this is a new church development in Cairo. You see the new construction going on in the background. And in the foreground, you can see some of what's left of the squatters area, if you will, that is being pushed out by the new growth on the outskirts of Cairo. It was a student that our church in Colorado Springs supported through his 4 years of seminary, who started this church out there just 4 years, 5 years ago now, as a first-year student. And now they have this apartment, which is not legal, but the owner of the building is one of the elders of the church. He's standing next to his wife here. So the church uses two flats of this unfinished building, one for worship and one for the kids, because the kids need as much room as worship, because there's a lot of kids. There's a lot of kids. Imad is the elder who owns the building. His wife, Abir, teaches a weekly women's Bible study that packs out the apartment also with 70 women. They sit all the way, partway down the stairs because they don't all fit in. And they can't spread because their kids are all in the rest of the apartment. It's an exciting ministry. Medhat is in the brown jacket. He's the one who started the church in the middle. Wonderful vision for service. They have been ministering both to the upper class, well, kind of middle upper class people moving in for the new apartments, and to the low, low class of those who are being pushed out and who are helping in the construction. So a few years ago, that group that they were reaching out to of the very poor began to meet as another congregation. And then the churches said, well, we should be meeting together. And so this upper middle class and the lower class church are worshiping together and sharing as a body. So we have illiterate people, and we have people who, you know, own and build apartment buildings. And they are a wonderful congregation together with a very varied ministry in that community. Every month, Medhat and the local leader of the mosque would go out to be seen publicly together and pick up trash in the streets. So, dear man. And enough of that. The clinic, the preschool, Abir. This is the view out the window. That's the piece of land that they would like to buy and build on. The man who works with the Synod and Cairo Presbytery in their new church development, and his wise words, yes, it's too big for us, but not for God. Cairo Presbytery has 18 official and many, many more unofficial new church development projects right now, all of which are seeking land and buildings and, yeah, right, in this economy. So the seminary, which enables all of this through training these folks, the pastors, you know, there was very much a sense as we were among them that they are preparing for ministry in a time that they have no idea what it will be like. And so they are seeking to build strong support amongst each other, because they have the sense that they are going to need that in the future, to be able to rely on each other. It was a privilege to be part of their fellowship. We spent a couple nights. That was the upside of wanting to be inside the seminary walls after dark each night, instead of out running around Cairo. We had wonderful fellowship times with the students in their dorm rooms in the evenings, singing and sharing stories, sense of call, fears, hopes. It was delightful. Wonderful young men. Egypt does not yet ordain women as pastors, but they do train them, and women are very active in many leadership roles. The seminary that this church is now partnering with, building a new addition next door to the seminary, that red building, in which the seminary will have one floor because they've outgrown all of their facility. National's gift. And I get, I don't know why, I just lucky, I guess, that I get the privilege of telling you what this church is a part of now through the Shaw grant made last month, a $64,000 gift. And there's over 3 years, it will total 109, to enable a new distance learning branch in El Minya, that city kind of in the middle of Egypt that I showed you up there, to serve southern and central Egypt. They expect at least 30 students the first year, which will be this coming fall, and that the entire extension will be self-supporting within 4 years. This is the region where most of the pastoral candidates in Egypt come from, and it fits the seminary's strategic vision to be equipping lay leaders as well as pastors, and to be doing it in the least disruptive way possible to families and ongoing ministry. It's a great gift of this church. The other thing that distance learning and those technologies will enable is for the seminary to be able to meet the needs of training of many of the Muslim background believers and their home churches, which meet all over the Middle East. And they will be able to access courses online. They, of course, cannot go to any public school or courses for training. And so this is a great opportunity that will help to serve them in the Arabic language. Dr. Tharwat in the back is the head of their mission department. For 100 years, the seminary had no mission department. They really saw themselves as a mission-receiving church. And in the 50s, they sent one missionary family to Sudan. And this was the man they brought in about 10 years ago to help them start a new mission department in the seminary. And I tell you, that place is busting with mission fervor and excitement. And yet Tharwat, who's sort of the explosion at the center of all of this fire, you know, is it just said again and again, pray against a spirit of fear in the church. The only thing stopping us is fear. And so I pass that along to you. This is Paul Roberts with us, who's the president of our Presbyterian Historic African American Presbyterian Seminary in Atlanta, who was part of this team, connecting up with the seminary in Cairo. The guy holding the orange, you'll probably recognize Magdi Quinn, who'd been in Sudan for a couple of summers. All the students are out doing church work or mission work in the summers. And he is looking to go fill the church pulpit in Basra, Iraq. They have been without a pastor for the last 5 years. So pray for Magdi and the church in Egypt as they look to send him as a missionary there. Dr. Atif Gendi is the president of the seminary, a dear man of God, and a wonderful visionary. With him are the Reverends Steve and Cinda, who are in the process of fundraising now within the PCUSA to go as co-workers to help the seminary and the synod of the Nile in Egypt. So they were part of our team, their first exposure to Egypt, and then accepted these calls when we were there. It was very exciting. Dr. Atif shared his words for this time, which is a call to the church in Egypt, but also to the church around the world, which is his word. You know, folks, this is a reminder that our theology is not first a theology of resurrection, but first a theology of incarnation, of living as Christ here where God has put us now, speaking and demonstrating by our lives of service God's love for the world. And then it is a theology of the cross. And then it is a theology of resurrection and of hope. So I will close with his words and with greetings from the church in Egypt. This is one of the churches in Cairo. I assured them that we will not forget them and we will stand with them in prayer, so don't let me become a liar. Get one of those purple handouts on your way out. June 1st is the next time that the church in Egypt has set for one of these ecumenical prayer days like they did on 11-11-11. And we can be part of it. And here are some prayer invitations. We'd also love for you to join us here at the church at 1 o'clock on Friday, June 1st, in the parlor if you'd like to pray with us. Promise of the future of Egypt. And the scripture that, of course, Egypt clings to, the Lord Almighty will bless them, saying, "Blessed be Egypt, my people." And all God's people said, "Amen." Amen. And that is indeed our prayer, that they would be blessed. Sorry, but I couldn't stop. Thank you, Nancy.